And it's an open phone segment on the Leonard Lopate Show here on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. And remaining with us by phone, at least at the top of the hour, are Joel S. Witt and Daniel B. Poneman, two of the three authors of a book called Going Critical, The First North Korean Nuclear Crisis from the Brookings Institution Press. So before we get to those calls, just one more thing. The North Korea is now about to engage in six-way talks with the United States, South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia. Do you have any hopes of anything positive coming out of them?
I don't know if the next round of talks have been agreed to or not, but these talks have been going on for over a year. And, you know, recently there were signs of some progress, although very minor progress. And I think now there's probably little or no hope that the talks will produce any substantial result before the U.S. presidential election. So I think right now we're in a holding pattern until after the U.S. election, and even then there's no guarantee that there'll be any results.
So I throw this question out to you, my listeners. Did our preemptive action in Iraq set a precedent that now affects our policy toward North Korea's nuclear program? And if President Bush justified war in Iraq over weapons of mass destruction that were never found, does it follow that a war with North Korea, which does have nuclear technology, or Iran, which is working to develop nuclear weapons, would be justified? Our number is 212-267-WNYC. And we go now to Doug from the Bronx. Hi, you're on New York Public Radio.
Okay, thanks. Before I answer the question that you just posed specifically, because I didn't hear, you know, that question earlier, I just wanted to make a comment about your question to the guest earlier when you said that some American diplomat had said that the Kim Jong-il would prefer Kerry as president, assuming that means that he would be easier on North Korea. I don't think you can be easier on North Korea than Bush has been, or made North Korea more powerful or more bellicose than Bush has. Actually, from the very beginning with Rumsfeld, actually instigated North Korea, beginning in early 2001, to start rearming itself. And then the preemptive policy that you were just talking about absolutely ensures that Iran and North Korea have a rationale to themselves, let alone to other countries in the world, to rearm themselves as in self-defense. The fact is that we were in much better shape under the greed framework in the 90s under the Clinton approach, if for no other reason than we had weapons inspectors, international weapons inspectors, had access to things in North Korea. We had our Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, went to North Korea. William Perry, I think, visited North Korea. We had a lot of diplomats going. So to some degree, we had actual objective vision of what was going on in North Korea. Now we have no objective knowledge of what's going on in North Korea whatsoever for all these Bush years, because they only show outsiders what they want them to see. And, you know, before we had some relatively higher access.
Well, let me bring my guests in, Joel and Dan.
I'd like to comment on that. That's a very good question. It points out a number of anomalies. And the first one is this complete anomaly between this very rigid and defiant rhetoric that is categorical in its opposition to not only any North Korean nuclear program, but basically to the North Korean regime, to the point where there has been no serious engagement with it. And the irony here, of course, is that very rigid, ostensibly harsh policy has produced absolutely the opposite effect in terms of effectively liberating North Korea to do whatever it wishes, because they're not engaged in any kind of a process that would lead them to any other result. And indeed, as your commenter suggested, in fact, the preemptive policy, if anything, made them hasten in that direction. Whereas, as he indicated, while we had inspectors on the ground, I want to reiterate that there was one very worrisome development in the 1990s where a specific facility was cited, and your your guest here, Joel Witt, actually went over and checked out the place, and we had much better insights into what they were doing, and we had much better leverage over what they were doing than we do today.
You want to add something, Joel?
Yeah, if I could add this, about Kerry being easier on the North Koreans than Bush. Look, I don't think anyone could be easier on the North Koreans than President Bush has been, because the approach has been a lot of rhetoric but no results. As I said earlier, North Korea's nuclear weapons program has grown over the past few years. And I think a rational strategy for dealing with North Korea has to give them escape route from the current crisis, but also show them that if they don't take the escape route, if they don't meet our demands, then tough measures are going to follow. But President Bush has not been able to make that work, and we don't have multilateral support for taking tough measures.
Doug, thank you so much for calling us.
I just add one other thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and to over to highlight that point, just what over a month ago, Bush said that in this realignment of U.S. forces, he would remove 12,000 U.S. troops from South Korea, and Kerry immediately criticized that and jumped on that. That gives more of a green light to North Korea.
Thank you so much. Ali from New Hyde Park. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a long-time listener of your program, and I enjoy it greatly. I'm a first-time caller. And I am originally from Iran. I'm now an American. I would like to ask your speakers and you yourself, what is the position of the United States about Iranian using peaceful atomic energy in a peaceful manner? Because, you see, you just said it, in fact, in your introduction, they are developing atomic weapons. Now, of course, they are saying we are not developing. International Atomic Energy is saying we have not found anything to that effect. But my point is this, because even if, for however they forego 100% to your satisfaction, to United States government satisfaction, a development of atomic weapons, I don't think United States wants Iran to develop atomic reactors for energy production. And then they say, oh, they have lots of oil. And my point is that, you see, as an Iranian, I feel really humiliated because you say we don't believe in Iran. No, because they can possibly, whatever they are developing, they might use it to develop atomic energy, atomic weapons, which, by the way, I'm 100% against. So let me make that point clear. So, and then here, this is coming from a country that, as Madeleine Albright said, admitted they actually changed the Iranian government in 1952. Now they are, you know that there is an opposition group who started suicide bombing in Iran, by the way, in Iraq, who was working with Saddam. Now United States government, who, State Department has declared them as a terrorist group. United States government, I heard it in the radio from a general, saying that we should arm this group so that they can attack Iran. Now, this is coming from a government. So this United States government is saying we don't believe in Iran.
Okay, Ali, let my guest respond. Daniel?
Please do.
I would just make a comment here. Iran, of course, is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And as a signatory, it is entitled to benefit from the peaceful applications of nuclear energy. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think there's any argument about that.
Can I comment on that?
No, not yet, because I'm not quite done. Forgive me. But just to complete the thought here, what is questioned is, and I think validly questioned, that Iran has pursued secretly a program to enrich uranium for 18 years, has not disclosed that to the International Atomic Energy Agency, has engaged in a number of other activities that it has failed to report, and therefore I think it is appropriate. I personally believe that the Iranian regime is pursuing a nuclear weapons option, and I think it would be tragic if the nuclear energy justification of the treaty were allowed to let slip a nuclear weapons program. So where would I draw the line? I would not try to bar Iran from enjoying nuclear energy. I would allow the completion, for example, of the Bushehr reactor, but I do not believe that it is either economically justifiable or frankly acceptable from a U.S. or international security perspective that Iran should have these secret fuel cycle facilities that could gain it access to plutonium and enriched uranium for bombs.
Ali, thank you for your call. And we go now to Kate from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, I'd just like to say I find this, plastering Bush because he used the word tyrants, which is the perfect description of this man. I find that repeating that again and again, it is so political.
Kate, we made the point that name calling had occurred on both sides. This was not singling out George Bush. I didn't say George Bush said this and what an idiot he is. I said that he said that, and then the North Koreans said something else. So why are you making it into a political thing?
Because it is so petty, even to talk about the name-calling. You have this man who is in reality a maniac who torments the people who are underneath him, and you're talking about George Bush using the word tyrant.
Okay, so Joel, what do you say?
Well, let me say something about that. Look, there's no doubt that Kim Jong-il is a tyrant, and his father was a tyrant. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that North Korea is an awful place to live. I've been to North Korea 15 times. It's not a nice place to live. The people are doing the best they can. Many of them have starved in the past 5 to 10 years.
Are they aware even of this debate that's going on? Are they aware of any nuclear weapons program? Does the government talk about that?
I think they're not aware of all the details here. What their people are aware of, and which the government keeps a constant drumbeat up about, is that they are being threatened by the United States, and therefore they have to do everything possible to defend their country and to defend their political system. And I don't think there's any dissent from that among the North Korean people.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that. I, of course, agree with your caller and with Joel. This is a despicable regime that has resulted in enormous, untold human suffering. It was really a small point. It was not a political point, and it could apply to any government at any time. When the stakes are as high as they are here, with nuclear weapons being at stake, I just think we need to be very careful in how we proceed and how we discuss the issue.
But I think you also were suggesting that name-calling rather than policy isn't always the best approach.
Yeah,
and
I,
that
I
you would have preferred to affirm a policy, and whether you call them a tyrant or not is irrelevant under those circumstances.
You know, Leonard, what we have here is the worst of both worlds. We have name-calling and no policy. You know, if we had name-calling and a policy to deal with this effectively, okay, but we don't have either. I mean, we have the worst part that we could have, and we don't have a policy.
But when the president came up with his axis of evil speech, many people were angered in this country and other parts of the world as well, not just the people he named, because they felt that it was just exacerbating a situation through rhetoric. Do you think that is bad diplomacy?
Well, it's probably good domestic politics and bad diplomacy. And, you know, since I spent 15 years in the State Department, I would say it's probably best not to name specific countries in a State of the Union address as members of the Axis of Evil. But I can understand why he did it. And honestly, I think the North Koreans could have lived with it probably if we had at the same time a policy for engaging them and for dealing with them. But we didn't have either. Once again, we had name calling and no policy. And I think that's what really bothered them.
Let's get another caller in here before we have to break for the news. Steve from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, Stephen. Listen, two things. First of all, the United States has practically no moral authority for telling anybody they can't have nuclear weapons, since we have such a huge stockpile. If they were to get rid of a mere 25%, which would leave, you know, many, 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 many megatons to destroy the world many times over, it would show some kind of faith on our part that we would be able to take to the world and say, okay, we have gotten rid of at least a portion of our arsenal. Let us have everybody else do the same thing. The other thing is, what could you really do to North Korea that hasn't already been done or hasn't been done by themselves? What kind of methods would you use to make their lives worse than they already are to put any pressure on them.
As far as the first thing is concerned, there are reported way over 1,000 nuclear missiles aimed at Russia right now on hair triggers, and the same in Russia aimed at the United States.
25%. Hey, you know.
Even that, we still wind up with 750 or more, don't we?
I think we could, you know, we could get rid of 25 or 35 or 45% and still have many, many, many times more than we could possibly need to destroy everything.
Okay, gentlemen, what do you say? Does the United States have any moral authority here? We were the first country to, and the only country in the world to ever use a nuclear weapon.
I think moral authority is a very tricky business, obviously. And I think we have done best, frankly, where we have kept our moral authority as a guidepost, but it has to embed our policy in our own, I think, cold strategic calculation. I certainly agree that there is some effect on other countries by the U.S. nuclear posture. That said, I think the dominant factor in any country's decision, North Korea, Iran, throughout the Middle East, Africa, wherever, is their own security environment. And the Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example, I think basically reassures countries within a region that their neighbors aren't going to take out actions against them.
We have to end it here. We are going to the news, but I don't know if either of you can stay past the news because we'll continue this conversation until 1:20. Tell us while we're on the break, and then we will announce it when we come back. But meanwhile, the conversation does continue after the news here on WNYC. My guests are Joel Witt, Daniel B. Poneman. They, along with Robert L. Gallucci, have written Going Critical, the first North Korean nuclear crisis, from Brookings Institution Press. I'm Leonard Lopate here on WNYC, 93.9 AM 820, online at WNYC.org. And with me is Joel S. Witt, a senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served for 15 years in the Department of State and was coordinator for the 1994 U.S.-North Korea Agreed Framework. We're taking your calls at 212-267-WNYC. Joel, you worked for both Democratic and Republican administrations, didn't you?
Right. I started in the State Department under the Reagan administration, then worked for the first Bush administration, and then the Clinton administration, and finally for a few years for this latest Bush administration.
Well, as coordinator for the 1994 Agreed Framework, is anyone calling upon you now to draw upon your expertise?
No, they aren't, and I think that's in part of the problem with the current administration's policies is they're not really talking to people who have experience dealing with North Korea. And the reason for that is because we all were part of the Clinton administration policy, you know, we're tainted now.
Let's take some more calls, okay? Our number here is 212-267-WNYC. Penelope from Manhattan, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to say about this is that it's a misnomer to say it's a preemptive strike, and it is very dangerous to use words that sound like you're protecting yourself from being attacked by using a word like that. It's similar to manifest destiny.
But wait. How does that apply to what we're talking about? If you're suggesting that if the United States decided to do something to take out North Korea's nuclear capability, that shouldn't be called a preemptive strike?
It's presupposing then that they are going to strike us, just like in the reasoning, the rationale to go to Iraq is that they had weapons of mass destruction, so therefore we had to enter that, and I think that the UN did it's an illegal war because it doesn't go by the accords of striking a country if there isn't a viable threat.
Well, this is actually one of the issues that's in the current campaign. But do you have any thoughts along these lines here, Joel, or should I go to the next call?
Well, I think there's a bottom line here, and the bottom line is that, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And, you know, whether we should have done what we did in Iraq or not, you know, I'm very skeptical, but you know, applying that kind of approach to a country like North Korea just won't work, because North Korea is a significantly greater threat, not just to us, but to our close allies who are next door to North Korea. So,
but wasn't that one of the reasons given for the fact that Iraq became the target? It was actually the easiest country to go after?
Well, you know, look, I'm not an expert on Iraq. That may have been the case.
And look how difficult it's turned out to be.
I could tell you that North Korea would be a much harder nut to crack, even though I believe that North Korea does have weapons of mass destruction. And I believe that the chances are maybe 80-20 that North Korea has nuclear weapons.
But it's still 80-20.
Yeah, well, you know, look, I used to be in the U.S. intelligence community, and nothing is certain. It's very rare when you have a smoking gun right there that guarantees you 100% that you're right. But in this case, you have a country that's been working on nuclear weapons since the 1960s. I mean, we know that Kim Il-sung in the early 1960s asked Mao Tse-tung for nuclear weapons. So he was interested even back then.
Let's take another call. Peter from Sunset Park. Hi, you're on New York Public Radio.
Hi, yeah, I had a question to ask you guys. How do you deal with a country that you just can't trust? When the Clinton administration sent Carter to North Korea, as I recall, they made a deal, and then the North Koreans completely broke the deal while we thought they were stopping their proliferation of nuclear weapons. So, you know, if you engage and it fails, and then the Bush administration has not engaged and that doesn't work, then what works?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and that's the crux of the problem here. You have these rogue states who you basically can't trust. How do you deal with them? Can you engage them if you can't trust them? Or what are the alternatives? And I would say the least worst option is to engage them. And let's use the case of North Korea and the agreement you're talking about, the 94 agreement. Sure, the North Koreans were caught cheating on that agreement. But I would argue that even if they were caught cheating, the agreement served our interests for the 8 years that it was in place. And I would argue that because if there had been no agreement and there had been no engagement of North Korea, and they were just allowed to do whatever they were doing, they would have a much larger stockpile of nuclear weapons today than what they have. So at the end of the day, it may not be emotionally satisfying, but from a pure policy perspective, I think what we've been doing has been effective.
Thank you so much for your call, Peter. Aaron from Teaneck, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for the call. My question is, we tend to focus on U.S. North Korean at a bilateral level. When can we actually use China and the relationship, you know, the Sino-North Korean relationship that's been there on and off for over 50 years as leverage? Because I really believe the Chinese have a very, very long-standing deep party-to-party relationship as communists with the North Koreans to actually start leveraging that relationship, given that we have a huge trade deficit with them, and given that we have obviously a tremendous amount of issues with the Chinese that we could trade, you know, horse trade with.
Once again, a very good question. Getting China to use its leverage against North Korea has been a central objective of U.S. policy in dealing with North Korea for at least the past decade. I mean, if we refer back to the crisis in 93 and 94, one of the reasons why the United States spent so much time sitting at the negotiating table trying to reach a deal with North Koreans was not just because we were being wimpy. It was because the Chinese had been urging us to do that over and over again, and we wanted to show the Chinese that we were doing what they wanted us to do, because if that didn't work, then we could get China to support tougher measures, use their leverage more. And indeed, in 1994, right before Jimmy Carter went to North Korea, China was willing to support sanctions at the UN against North Korea. That was an enormous accomplishment. Same thing is happening today. The Bush administration is trying to get China to support our approach. The problem is the Chinese don't think the United States really has a viable approach. And that's one of the reasons why the Bush administration's policy hasn't been that effective.
So we're waiting for China to tell us what they really want, and they're waiting for us to come up with something that they feel they can go along with?
Well, what we're trying to do, or what we should be trying to do, is to fashion an approach that gets Chinese support. By that I mean, if we engage North Korea seriously, talk to them, which is what the Chinese today want us to do, but we haven't done, we talk to them and the North Koreans show everyone they're not interested in a diplomatic settlement, then the Chinese might support tougher measures against the North Koreans. But we haven't demonstrated that today because the Bush administration isn't willing to seriously discuss this issue with the North Koreans.
Thank you so much for calling us, Aaron. Anton from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I got to tell you, I had two relatives lost in the World Trade Center, so I may be slightly emotional about this, but I'm kind of upset at the present administration and the course they've been taking. It's been saying, "You're North Korea, you're our enemy. We're going to put you in this corner, and we're not going to deal with you." I don't see any solution in that. And my question is, what would be so wrong for the United States to actually, like, put their hand out and say, hey, we're the superpower in the world. We'd like to make friends. Let's see if we can resolve our problems. What would be the deficit, the disadvantage to that?
You know, I get the feeling this is kind of sounding very partisan here, and I'm going to totally agree with you. And I want to try to appeal to people's logic here. The Bush administration obviously thinks North Korea is a serious threat to the international community and has raised on a number of occasions the possibility that North Korea might assist terrorist groups. That's the first point. The second point is, at the same time, the administration's policy has let North Korea build up a growing stockpile of materials that might be used to build nuclear weapons. To me, that seems illogical. If you're afraid a country is going to provide these kinds of materials to terrorist groups, then you should do everything possible to at least minimize their ability to produce these materials and maybe even end their ability to produce these materials, and I would hasten to add, through diplomatic measures. But that hasn't happened.
Thank you so much for your call. What have we learned from the Pakistani-Indian standoff on nuclear weapons? Can any of that be applied?
Well, there's an interesting connection between that and what's going on with North Korea today, and let me try to explain that to you. North Koreans looking around the world at different models for the future of their country, I think many of them are thinking about Pakistan as a future model for North Korea. And by that I mean Pakistan has built its nuclear weapons program up. It conducted a nuclear test. Of course, there was an initial very negative reaction to that. But Pakistan has weathered the storm, and Pakistan has continued with its nuclear program. And that model, I think, appeals to many North Koreans who feel that nuclear weapons are indispensable to their future. So, in effect, the Pakistani model has given encouragement to people inside North Korea who want to have their own nuclear arsenal.
Joel Witt is co-author, along with Daniel B. Poneman and Robert L. Gallucci, of Going Critical, the first North Korean nuclear crisis, published by the Brookings Institution Press. And I thank you so much. And please, if you speak to Dan soon, thank him as well. It's been a fascinating hour and 15 minutes.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.